It is Tuesday, October 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump disparages a former aide's cooperation with prosecutors in the Russia probe. A humanitarian crisis is reported to be worsening in Syria. And singer Camila Cabello releases a song that's rising on the charts. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump condemned one-time foreign policy adviser George Papadopoulos Tuesday, a day after it was disclosed that he pleaded guilty to lying to federal agents, but has been cooperating with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian interference in the U.S. election. In a new Twitter comment from the White House, Trump said few people knew the young, low-level volunteer named George, who was already proven to be a liar. Check the Dems. U.S. news outlets gave widespread coverage of Papadopoulos' guilty plea in early October and the indictment of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and his protege Rick Gates on money laundering and conspiracy charges linked to their multi-million-dollar lobbying effort for one-time Ukrainian strongman Viktor Yanukovych. Elizabeth Hempelwitz is director of public policy at the Project on Government Oversight, a nonpartisan organization that investigates fraud, abuse, and conflicts of interest in the U.S. government. The organization believes Congress should continue the Russian investigations on a nonpartisan basis. I asked her why her organization believes laws are not adequate to ensure that foreign influence is kept out of the U.S. government.
So we've done some work on the Foreign Agents Registration Act now for, I think, going on like 6 years. So we started looking into this specific act that I think is kind of at the center of the indictments and kind of the conversation that's happening in Washington right now. And what we found when we began looking into it is that this law that's, you know, meant to kind of introduce a little bit transparency into lobbying in terms of when it's being done for foreign governments, but it's like only enforced, it's the enforcement of this law, so it requires disclosures and transparency, but it's not enforced. And so it's essentially almost useless, because I think in the time since it's been enacted, it's only been, you know, somebody's been charged under it only 7 times. And of those 7, only 2 times, I think, were carried all the way through. And the problem is that's not because there haven't been violations. It's because the violations, the enforcement is based on self-reporting. And so I think that's, you know, kind of where the root of this problem is. The way that the law is structured right now isn't solving the problem that it was meant to solve.
When was this law enacted?
1938.
Yes. Oh, so this has been in effect then quite a while.
Right.
Yeah, just that's interesting, because I would think over the last certainly 2 decades, there's probably a lot more international communication, more international influence.
Right. Right. And another problem with it is that there are, I think there's like six or seven categories of people who can be exempt under it if they fall into a certain categorization. And one of those is for lawyers. Another is for somebody who's a registered lobbyist. And so it creates this gray area of whether or not individuals do need to register under FARA at all, which, again, then complicates enforcement of it. Because people, you know, either don't know or think they can fit into, you know, a small loophole or claim, you know, plausible deniability that they didn't know they needed to register.
Some observers feel that lobbyists are sort of an unofficial part of government anyway, and they tend to operate under their own, get away with what they can.
Right. Well, what you're required to file under the Lobbying Disclosure Act is much less than what you'd be required to file under FARA. And so it makes sense that people would rather go that route. There's a lot less transparency around, you know, the actual conversations you're having as a lobbyist, the materials that you're handing out that you would be required to file under FARA.
President Trump responded to the announcement of the indictments and the guilty plea as well by saying that the Justice Department and Congress should be focusing on the activities of former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the sale of a uranium mining company to Russians during President Obama's administration. You know, some people are saying, well, that he's just trying to deflect. But I believe your organization feels that that is a legitimate issue.
Right. Well, I don't think it needs, I think the way that the president is framing it right now is an either or. We don't take that position. You know, we think if there is something to be looked into by Congress there, then they absolutely should. But that doesn't mean that there isn't also room for Congress to be working in this space. So I think the idea that Congress and the Justice Department have to pick one of these issues and only focus on that is that's kind of the part of this that doesn't really make much sense to me. So I think we take the position that, you know, if there is something that requires congressional attention here in either one of these instances, then they have the resources and the ability to conduct multiple investigations at one time.
Elizabeth Hempelwitz, Director of Public Policy at the Project on Government Oversight. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, after a busy day of news yesterday when we talked about indictments and all of these investigations going on, there was a bit of news made last night that kind of caught everyone by surprise. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, in an interview with Fox News, said that the lack of ability to compromise led to the Civil War. He's talking about the Confederate monuments that caused all the protests over the summer. He also said there were men and women of good faith on both sides of the fight between the Union and the Confederacy. This was quite a shock to quite a lot of people, saying that it wasn't compromise that drove the fight, it was the preservation of slavery. And to hear someone like John Kelly, who's not only the White House Chief of Staff, but a former general, talk about the war in that way was quite surprising for people. So Kelly has not spoken out yet against those words or about those words, but it is getting a lot of attention today. Someone else getting a lot of attention, George Papadopoulos. Of course, he was the Trump campaign advisor who was charged with trying to get information on Hillary Clinton during the campaign. But it's also the name of a financial advisor in Michigan. And people on Twitter are tweeting at and talking at the wrong George Papadopoulos. So the financial planner, George Papadopoulos, has written on Twitter. He says, for the nth time, I am not Trump's foreign policy advisor. I have no association with the Trump camp. He said, I'm visiting Greece with my mother today. So it's kind of been surreal to keep up with. So again, another instance of mistaken identity on social media. And just a reminder, make sure if you're going to tweet at someone, you have the right person that you're tweeting at.
The right person. That's true. Okay. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor, Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A suicide blast kills 8 people in Kabul's diplomatic zone. Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga is calling the Kenyan president's election win a sham. Technology lawyers are set to testify before Congress on the Russian election meddling. An ousted Catalan leader is in Brussels as Spanish prosecutors seek charges. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Pennsylvania State University astronomers studying Hubble Space Telescope observations found that it snows titanium oxide on half of the hot exoplanet Kepler-13ab. Titanium oxide is one of the key ingredients in sunscreen. Kepler-13ab is part of a multiple star system with at least 3 solar components and is located some 1,730 light-years from Earth. The exoplanet is tidally locked to its primary star, Kepler-13a, which means it has a permanent day and night side, like the Moon is with Earth. The titanium oxide snow was found to be falling on the night side of the planet. The astronomers say Kepler-13ab orbits its primary star so closely that the day side of the exoplanet is about 2760 degrees Celsius. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Australia closes a controversial offshore migrant camp. The UN Security Council was warned Monday that a serious humanitarian crisis is intensifying in Syria, even as Islamic State militants are being driven out of Raqqa. The UN Emergency Relief Coordinator, Mark Lowcock, said more than 400,000 civilians have been displaced by a year of fighting in and around Raqqa, while death, injury, and displacement have impacted hundreds of thousands more in recent months in eastern Deir ez-Zor. Overall, Lowcock said more than 13 million people in Syria are in need of humanitarian assistance.
6.3 million of them are exceptionally vulnerable and in acute need as a result of displacement, hostilities, and limited access to basic goods and services. Military operations and hostilities in some parts of the country, particularly in the east, continue to drive displacement. The number of long-term internally displaced people, IDPs, has decreased from 6.3 to 6.1 million over the last year. But levels of new displacement remain high, with some 1.8 million reported to have been displaced between January and September. Humanitarian access to eastern Ghouta, one of the four de-escalated areas where nearly 95% of Syria's besieged population lives, has been severely curtailed for months. Today, the UN and partners delivered food, nutrition, and health assistance to 40,000 people. An alarming number of child malnutrition cases have been recorded there, and more than 400 people with health problems require medical evacuation.
David Lesh, Trinity University history professor, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, the Syrian regime has used access to humanitarian assistance as a weapon to force concessions from rebels and their supporters and submission to its control.
The crisis point of this conflict in terms of being a situation that could ravel out of control into the entire Middle East has subsided somewhat with what appears to be, you know, the regime stabilizing itself with the support of Iran and Russia in particular, and the Syrian opposition having been reduced to just a shadow of what it used to be.
If food is being used as a weapon by the Syrian regime, does that amount to a war crime that ought to be prosecuted?
I think on the surface, it certainly seems to be. The details of these types of things have to be discussed at appropriate levels in the International Crimes Division and in the UN and so forth. But this has been a charge against the regime throughout the conflict. They will put forth strategic reasons or a rationale that it's unsafe and so forth. And there's just enough activity to lend some credence to that notion. So it's very hard to prove.
The seventh round of the so-called Astana talks involving Russia, Turkey, and Iran in the Kazakh capital resumed on de-escalating the six-year-long conflict. What hope do you have for any progress?
Well, it's made some significant progress in terms of establishing de-escalation zones, particularly cooperation between Russia, Iran, and most importantly, Turkey on that front, because Turkey has a great deal of influence with a number of the Syrian opposition groups. So there has been some progress, and therefore there are notable pockets where the conflict has been reduced significantly, and that has allowed for humanitarian access and allowed for some return to normalcy. But it's important to remember that the Astana process really is dealing with security issues. It is not necessarily dealing with a political settlement. I think the Russians have admitted that they would like the United States and the international community involved, and they still maintain connections with the UN Special Envoy in the Geneva process to try to generate some sort of political settlement which will allow for the long-term resolution of the Syrian conflict.
David Lesh of Trinity University. Australia has closed its controversial offshore detention center in Papua New Guinea, but more than 600 refugees and asylum seekers are refusing to leave. The men say they fear for their safety in the local community and are uncertain about their future. Australian officials have left the facility, and water and power supplies are being switched off. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
About 600 men remain inside the Papua New Guinea detention center. Most of them are refugees, including many from Myanmar, Iran, and Afghanistan. They insist they're too scared to leave the processing center and are refusing to move to new accommodation elsewhere on the island. They say they've stockpiled food and water, and it's unclear when or if they'll be forced out by Papua New Guinea authorities. Senator Nick McKim, an immigration spokesperson for the Australian Greens, says the detainees fear for their safety.
They don't believe it's safe here in the Manus community for them, and we've seen, you know, multiple machete attacks and knife attacks over recent months, and the guys are in the fear for their lives.
Advocates say about 480 of the 600 men inside the Manus Island facility are refugees. The rest are asylum seekers, many of whom have had their refugee claims rejected. The fate of all of them is unclear. Papua New Guinea says the men are Australia's responsibility. But Canberra won't resettle any of the Manus Island detainees under tough asylum and border protection policies. Kate Schutze, a researcher with the rights group Amnesty International, claims the Manus Island detainees are being abandoned by Australia.
Essentially, there's no real plan here for them to be able to rebuild their lives. So that's really quite alarming. All indications around these new centres and the security around these new centres seems to indicate that they're moving them from one prison to another with no logical rationale behind it.
Since 2013, Australia has incarcerated all asylum seekers who try to reach its shores by boat on Manus Island and Nauru, a tiny Pacific republic. Canberra has said the policy deters people trafficking and prevents deaths at sea. But the conditions inside the camps have been described by the United Nations and human rights groups as cruel. The United States has agreed to resettle some of the refugees from Manus Island and Nauru under a deal Australia reached with the Obama administration last year. In September, 22 men, including those from Sudan, Bangladesh and Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar, became the first to be moved from the offshore detention centre in Papua New Guinea to the United States. It's unclear how many refugees Washington will eventually resettle. In return, Australia will take in Central American refugees from the United States. Last year, a court in Papua New Guinea ruled the Australian-funded camp on Manus Island was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. A young singer from Miami has a new single that's getting international attention. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the details.
Today we're talking about Camila Cabello. And you may or may not know her name as a solo artist, but you certainly know the band that she came from, Fifth Harmony. She was with Fifth Harmony from the beginning when they were discovered on The X Factor in 2012. She was the first member of the group to leave to pursue a solo career. She did that this past January. And today we're going to be talking about her second single. The first one, Crying in the Club, did very well from her debut album, which is The Hurting, the Healing, the Loving. And she had to delay that album release. It was supposed to come out within the last few months, but she's pushed it to 2018. Apparently, she and her producing team are not real satisfied with the outcome of the album, so they're going to tweak a few things and release it a little later on. But the new single is doing so well, it's number one this week in the UK. So congratulations to Camila for that success. And it's her first top 10 hit in the United States. So with all that buildup, let's check out Camila Cabello, and the song is called Havana.
Havana.
So what is Carmela known for in the music business?
Well, she's 20. She's not known for a whole lot right now, other than being in Fifth Harmony. She is a rising star for sure. The music video for the song Havana, which we just heard, has already attracted over 100 million views. She performed on stage at the Latin American Music Award Show last week, and she's getting a lot of attention. She's very proud of her Cuban heritage. She's Cuban-American, having grown up in Miami. And the music video is a very Latin-flavored video where some guy and girl are in bed. They get caught by his girlfriend, and it becomes a dramatic event. And so she's in the video singing the new song, Havana. She said she has an alter ego, which is kind of interesting. I mean, Beyonce made the alter ego famous with Sasha Fierce. But according to Camila, her alter ego's name is Carla. She's normally reserved as Camila. She's a very quiet girl. She has been known to have anxiety and panic attacks. In fact, during a Fifth Harmony show last year, she ran off the stage in one of her anxiety attacks. So she likes to channel her outer-going, more vibrant, wild self through this person called Carla, who makes an appearance in this video as well, where she really lets loose. And she's been on tour with Bruno Mars for his 24 Karat Magic Tour. She is getting set to perform on the Billboard Latin Music Award Show. And, of course, she's going to go out on her own solo tour as well to support the new album, which is The Hurting, The Healing, The Loving, and Havana is her second song off the album, already number one in the UK.
Be interesting to have a meeting between Carla and Camila.
I always found it interesting how these people who are one thing can all of a sudden dig deep and find another part of their personality and call it something else. Because if it's in there, it's in there.
Right.
You know, but there you go. Camila Cabello, the first to leave Fifth Harmony. There's now new talk that maybe the group is breaking up, although the members say that's not the case. But Dina has just recorded a new solo single. And Lauren has a new solo single coming out with her boyfriend Ty Dolla $ign. And Normani, who was on Dancing with the Stars, she has signed a solo artist management contract. But she says, no, I'm not leaving the band, but she signed to be represented as a solo artist. So the future is unclear for Fifth Harmony. It is clear for Camila Cabello. She's on the fast track to fame and fortune.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has supported Burma's gradual transition toward an open democratic society in recent years. But at the same time, we express our gravest concern with recent events in Rakhine State and the violent, dramatic abuses Rohingya and other communities have endured, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. It is imperative, she said, that any individuals or entities responsible for atrocities, including non-state actors and vigilantes, be held accountable. That's why the United States is taking the following actions. Since August 25th, the United States has ceased consideration of JADE Act travel waivers for current and former senior leadership of the Burmese military. The U.S. is considering economic options available to target individuals associated with atrocities. All units and officers involved in operations in northern Rakhine State are considered to be ineligible to receive or participate in any U.S. assistance programs. The U.S. has rescinded invitations for senior Burmese security forces to attend U.S.-sponsored events. The U.S. is working with international partners to gain access to relevant areas for the United Nations fact-finding mission, international humanitarian organizations, and media. The U.S. is consulting with allies and partners on accountability options at the U.N., the U.N. Human Rights Council, and other appropriate venues. And the U.S. is also exploring targeted sanctions. The United States will continue to support Burma's transition to democracy, as well as efforts to resolve the current crisis in Rakhine State, which has caused more than 600,000 Rohingya to flee since August 25th. The government of Burma, including its armed forces, must take immediate action to ensure peace and security, implement commitments to ensure humanitarian access to communities in desperate need, facilitate the safe and voluntary return of those who have fled or been displaced in Rakhine State, and address the root causes of systematic discrimination against the Rohingya by implementing the Rakhine Advisory Commission's recommendations, which includes providing a credible path to citizenship. The United States stands ready to support these efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.